This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. My name is Kev Lochin and I'm joined today by the delightful noise of news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
Good morning.
And editorial assistant Ian Todd.
Hello.
This special festive episode, we're taking a little look at the 12 months past and some of its biggest stories. We've got some choice interviews lined up and we're going to take a sneaky glimpse at 2018. Plus, I've got a special Game of the Year edition of News Bingo for these guys in the studio and for you, our listeners at home. But first, 2017. Good year, bad year, guys?
There's certainly been a lot going on. Quite a few major discoveries have come out.
It also feels like it's been very much a year of marking the calendar in the sense of anniversaries and a couple of goodbyes.
Yeah, there's been a couple of pretty big anniversaries. Sputnik comes to mind.
Sputnik, and then less comes to mind, but quite sad, Laika the dog.
Yes, poor Laika. I was actually really surprised. I hadn't quite sort of realised just how soon after Sputnik they sent up Laika. It was like 2 months.
It was it Khrushchev who was really keen to capitalise
on the
propaganda value of it, and so like, straight away, right, put another one up.
Is that one of those situations where they did get good science out of that, or was that just kind of, I don't want to say PR stunt, because that kind of trivialises, you know,
the main thing that Sputnik proved that they could get something into orbit, and that worked. And Laika proved that you could send a living creature into orbit and they would survive. Unfortunately, she didn't come back, but they proved that we could one day send people into space.
Mm. Also, Cassini, we have to mention as well.
Yes, that was a fond farewell.
Yes.
It had done its mission.
I know. I remember just before the finale, NASA released this quite nice video, and it was kind of like it showed, you know, images and the highlights and all the kind of, you know, quite sad piano music. And at the end, when it was kind of showing, you know, the animation of what it might look like to see Cassini deorbit into Saturn's atmosphere, I actually felt a lump in my throat. I was actually, oh, this is actually quite sad for Cassini.
It was around Saturn for 13 years, so that's, you know, it's a good chunk of my life it's been up there.
Also, we've had the 50th anniversary of the Saturn V rocket.
And Voyager.
And Voyager,
Can't forget Voyager.
40 years of Voyager.
Yeah. We spoke to quite a lot of cool people this year in terms of Voyager. Obviously, when we were putting together the special edition, the Voyager special edition that came out around the same time as the anniversary. Really interesting to kind of go back and talk to those planetary scientists like Carolyn Porco and Bonnie Baratti, the people who actually made some of the incredible discoveries like volcanicity on Io and things like that. Just how impressive that mission was and is.
Because it's still going. Inconceivably, it's been flying for 2/3 of the entire space age.
Yeah, it's especially when you think about it, it's, you know, sort of probably your washing machine has more programming power than it does.
It does. one thing we talked about for Camino is the kind of the weirdest things you guys had discovered over the past year. And the weirdest thing I discovered, I thought, is related to Voyager, because I did quite a lot of work on that special edition. And you can't remember anything, the Voyager spacecraft. Every time it sends data out, it has to wipe itself because its brain is basically an 8-track tape player. So this thing that is like, you know, has discovered so much, it's got a really bad short-term memory, and it's got less. It's got 240,000 times less computing power than an average iPhone.
Yeah, it's one of those weird kind of, everybody thinks that like the space age and all of these space probes are the cutting edge, like the bleeding edge of technology. But most of the time, by the time that you've designed it and built it and put it into orbit, it's 20 years out of date.
Exactly that, because you're right, it was in 1970.
Probably it launched in 1977, which means it was being built like 5 years before that. So this is 1972 technology here.
Wow. And still working. It's amazing.
And still going.
I remember...
They built them to last in those days.
Was it US who spoke to Suzanne Dodd?
Yes.
And it was in her interview, she was saying how they have to kind of take decisions to kind of take little bits of it offline one at a time and to see how much they can eke out of it.
Yes, I think they said they lose about 4 watts of power a year, and it's sort of sitting there going, it's like, does that heater really need 12? Or will 10 do?
10 it off and hope.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
So what about you guys? What's the weirdest thing you've learned this year?
Well, I always kind of, I think as the discovery of exoplanets is becoming a more common occurrence, you just constantly get these exoplanets being discovered that just have these crazy properties. So I've been kind of looking at, like, there were like two hot Jupiters discovered over the past year that kind of blew my mind. And a hot Jupiter is so-called because it's about the same size or larger than Jupiter, but it orbits its star a lot closer than Jupiter does to the star in our solar system, the Sun.
Thanks for clarifying that.
Just in case anyone's wondering. So in June, there was the announcement of a Jupiter-like exoplanet that is hotter than most stars. So it's called KELT-9b, and it's 2.8 times more massive than Jupiter, even though it's only half as dense. And they think this is because extreme radiation from its host star has caused the planet to expand like a balloon. But the planet is tidally locked, which means that the same side always faces the star, just like the moon around Earth.
Sure.
And this means that one side of the planet is in constant perpetual daylight, which means that the surface temperature is about 4,500 degrees Celsius. To put that in comparison, our sun is 5,500 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
And they think that also it's possible that the planet could be leaving like a kind of tail in its wake.
What, even like a cometary?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. And the other interesting thing is that it orbits the star perpendicular to its spin axis. So that would be like, if you could picture our solar system and all the planets going around it, that would be like a planet going perpendicular, like 90 degrees to the way...
Well, it's like Uranus, right? Spinning. It spins on its side.
Yeah, exactly that kind of thing, yeah. And then in October, there was another hot Jupiter announced, which snows titanium dioxide, which is a... common ingredient in sunscreen. So kind of press officers had a field day, you know, kind of with this headline that there's a planet that where it rains sunscreen.
And is that like close to its star? Like, is that useful? You go stand there and you stand in the snow and then you're fine?
Or? Exactly, that's what I was thinking, because it's another hot Jupiter. It's called Kepler 13AB, and it's also tidally locked. So on its day side, temperatures can reach 2,700 degrees Celsius. And they think that on its dark side, that's when titanium oxide gas is carried to the colder nighttime side. It condenses and then rains as snow. So I was thinking, so does that kind of cancel it out? So if you're on that planet, even though it's 2,500 degrees Celsius, you're fine because it's raining sunscreen?
I think you might have a slight other problems if it's 2,500 degrees Celsius.
So Ian's picked out some nice exoplanets and menagerie. Ez, what have you got for us?
Well, I've got a couple of things. The first one was in April of this year, the Event Horizon Telescope attempted to take an image of the central black hole in our galaxy, Sagittarius A star.
Mm-hmm.
But they've only just managed to get all of the data for that back, because it turns out one of the sort of real crunch points in when you're doing these kinds of like massive things is actually getting everything to the same place at the same time. I kind of had this picture that there was all these, you know, like high speed networks transferring data all over the place. But actually the thing that was really difficult was getting the data out of the South Pole because it got snowed in. So whether or not we've managed to image the black hole at the center of our galaxy was snowed in at the South Pole for about 6 months. And me, being the kind of person that I am, tried to work out what the maximum bandwidth that you could get between the South Pole and MIT, where everything was being processed.
Okay.
And the best one that I could come up with was 2 million gigabytes per second, which is an Airbus A380 stuffed with SD cards. And if anybody can find a better bandwidth than that, then please let us know. And my next bit is phrased as a news bingo question, special bonus one. You're going to get one, Kev, now.
Oh.
later this month, later in December, Elon Musk and SpaceX are planning on launching their Falcon Heavy rocket for the first time. What are they planning on putting on it as a test payload?
So I do know this because that comes up later on, but not in News Bingo.
Okay.
We'll get onto that. So, Ian?
Oh, that sounds really familiar. Sounds like we discussed this in the past few weeks.
No. I can give you a clue.
No, I can't remember.
He's going to put on it a Midnight Cherry Tesla Roadster playing Space Oddity.
So he's going to launch his car?
Yeah, considering that on the Dragon they put a wheel of cheese...
Hmm.
Which apparently is some reference I don't understand, but yeah, it's one of those things. If you're going to run a space company, why not launch a car into the orbit of Mars, which is the plan?
No, so I am going to counter News Bingo you.
Yes.
Do you know, this comes from a Twitter kind of debate he has, do you know what book he's going to put in a glove box of said car?
No.
With a towel.
Is it going to be Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Indeed it is.
Yes. Because I think the Wheel of Cheese was a reference to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Okay.
But I don't know it that well, apparently, so.
Shall we move on to some of the bigger news items of 2017?
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, we've just kind of discussed how interesting exoplanets are and kind of hot Jupiters. But, a real breakthrough, I guess, in... exoplanet discovery and hunting came in February, which seems like a long time ago now. Yeah, the discovery of TRAPPIST-1, which is a planetary system about 39 light years away from our solar system. Kind of interesting there, you're talking about like putting cheese, sending cheese into space. TRAPPIST-1, the telescope is called TRAPPIST, and it was actually named after a famous style of Belgian beers. I mean, the acronym is Transiting Planets and Planetesimals Small Telescope, but the team that led the discovery are some Belgian astronomers at the University of Liège, and they named it after their favourite style of beer.
That must have been a good night when I decided that.
Yeah, I wonder how they celebrated. And the interesting thing about this discovery is that it's actually seven kind of Earth-sized rocky planets in orbit around it. They've all got kind of like sizes and masses like Earth and Venus, and they're rocky, so not just discovering like ridiculously hot gassy planets that are massive, it's kind of the idea that we found so many potentially habitable planets, some of which could be in the so-called Goldilocks zone, meaning that liquid water could pool on their surfaces.
But that's the crux of it, right? It's not just we found a Earth-like planet, seven of them. Mm. All seven are Earth-like?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of their size and masses, they're, yeah, similar to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the really interesting thing about it is that it is the orbits, because their orbits, I think, like, the innermost planet orbits, its year is, like, an Earth day and a half, and then the outermost planet orbits in 20 days. So they orbit really, really close to the star, but the reason that they are potentially habitable is because the star is so cool. It's like an ultra-cool red dwarf star. So it's almost like they kind of... The proximity of their orbits is cancelled out by the fact that the star is a lot cooler. So we think that they could receive like light similar to the light that the planets in our solar system receive.
Huh. And they're closer to their star than Earth is, say, two hours.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, which you can kind of tell by the orbits, the fact that, you know, it's able to orbit in the, you know, the innermost planet is able to orbit in the period of like 1.5 Earth days.
Mm-hmm. I think even the outermost, it's only like 20 days.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
It's
just,
yeah.
But the scientists who discovered this, they've been running models to kind of try and simulate the orbits of the planets and then kind of work out the relationship to each other and how the system might develop over time. And when they were initially running the simulations, it didn't work. Like, the planets kept kind of crashing into each other. But then they observed the TRAPPIST-1 system a bit longer, and they worked out that there's this kind of really interesting resonance between the orbits of the planets. So it's like, so for every two orbits that the outermost planet, TRAPPIST-1H, makes, the other six worlds go around it 3, 4, 6, 9, 15, and 24 times, respectively.
That's a bit weird.
So there's this kind of resonance, this kind of like nice, neat ratio that kind of stabilizes the system, because it's about, like, they think it could be up to, like, twice as old as our solar system.
All right.
Mm. And they think that's the reason that it's survived for so long, is because it's got this kind of cool, like, stable, resonant orbits between the planets. So it's pretty awesome. It's a pretty cool discovery. But obviously, you know, there's only so much we can actually learn from the various releases. The first interview that we're going to be presenting today is I spoke to Dr. Hannah Wakeford, who's a planetary scientist who's part of the team that are currently carrying out follow-up observations of the TRAPPIST-1 system with the Hubble Space Telescope. And I began by asking her why she believes the discovery of TRAPPIST-1 system is so important.
The discovery of the TRAPPIST-1 system is so important because these worlds are our best chance to study alien Earth-sized planets for the next decade, at least. What I think has really captured the imagination is that these seven Earth-sized worlds are all in one system. The planets are the best targets that we have for these rocky worlds. And having seven of them orbiting just one star is such a great opportunity for scientists to learn about these planets' environments and how a star can affect such a system, because we can use them as individual kind of test tubes for what happens to a planet's atmosphere if it's really close to its star, what happens if it's in this liquid water habitable zone, and what happens if it's too far out. So it's like this really great kind of laboratory test that we can do that's out there in space.
And what do we actually know so far about the planets orbiting TRAPPIST-1?
So we already know quite a lot about these planets, considering that they're 40 light years away. Because the planets transit the star, we can actually get the radius of all of the planets relative to the size of the star. And because of that, we can also understand how they're inclined relative to us. But because there's seven of them so close to each other, they're pulling on each other. All of them are pulling on each other, and they're all pulling on the star. And we can use something called transit timing variations to work out the mass of each of these planets. So if we've got the radius that we've measured from the transit, and we've got the mass measured from these transit timing variations that we're seeing, we can actually work out what the bulk density of those planets is. And we actually do know that all of these worlds orbiting TRAPPIST-1 are likely to be rocky planets.
And so, considering that they're rocky planets, do we know whether or not any of them are likely to be able to support human life, or indeed already support some kind of life, you know, be it microbial?
So we don't know if any of these are actually habitable yet, and we do not know whether there's any life on them whatsoever. But what we're doing is we're using the Hubble Space Telescope at the moment, actually, to look at these worlds and try and work out what their atmospheres are like. So there's lots of different things that we can look for. And right now, with the Hubble Space Telescope, we're trying to rule out the fact that these planets are more Neptune-like. So we're trying to rule out that they have this big, puffy hydrogen-helium atmosphere. And we've actually done that for two of the planets in the system already, and we're working on the rest of them right now. And then in the future, so with the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope in 2019, we're actually going to learn even more about these planets, really get down and try and understand what their atmospheres are made of. And that's really important for habitability. But right now, what we understand is the temperature that these planets are likely to be, and from that we can try and work out what their environments might be like and what we should be looking for.
Just more generally, obviously whenever we're looking for exoplanets, we search for a star, because a star may have a planet, you know, transiting in front of it. Is there a specific kind of star that we look for in order to try and discover exoplanets?
The search for exoplanets is not limited to any one type of star, but some stars make it easier for us to find exoplanets. So exoplanets have actually been discovered around all types of stars, from the biggest and hottest stars to the smallest and coldest, like the TRAPPIST-1 star. And if you want to look for smaller planets using the transiting method, then it actually makes it much easier if you're looking at a smaller star. Because what we're actually measuring is the relative size of that planet to the size of the star. So if you have a smaller star, then you can look for a smaller planet because it will have the same signal as a large star with a large planet. So looking at these smaller stars makes it easier to look for these smaller planets. But it's not just smaller planets we're really interested in. We're trying to learn about all different types. So we need to look at all different types of stars. And stars like our sun, which is really important because we know that stars like our sun can host Earth-sized planets as well. So we really need to try and understand all of these different types of environments.
And so once an exoplanetary system is actually discovered, what's the next step? What do astronomers then do in order to find out more about it?
We always want to know more about planets that we discover. That's the fun part for me. We already are doing follow-up of the TRAPPIST-1 planets with the Hubble Space Telescope. What we're doing is we're looking at the starlight that shines through the planet's atmosphere before it reaches the telescope. So as the planet passes in front of the star, it transits it. Some of that starlight's actually going to be filtered through the planetary atmosphere before it reaches us. And imprinted on that light is the signatures of different molecules that make up the atmosphere. And the wonder of nature is that each molecule has its own unique fingerprint, and we can look for these in that light and try and work out what the atmosphere is made of. That's really the first step that we're doing, trying to understand these planets. But as I said before, the radius and the mass give us the bulk density, and that's really the first step in characterizing these planets.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much for speaking to me, Dr. Wakeford.
Thank you.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
One of the other big discoveries that was made this year was the first ever direct observation of the source of gravitational waves. Gravitational waves are basically ripples in space-time that are generated basically when something, pretty much everything creates gravitational waves, but we can only really appreciate them when it's something really, really big happens, like the collision of two black holes or two neutron stars, something like that. And we first saw one back in 2015 that was picked up by the LIGO detector. That's the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, of which there are two observatories over in America. And in August this year, something a bit more interesting happened, which is they didn't just detect the gravitational wave, they managed to pick up the light from the thing that actually created this, which was a huge boon because it meant that they could do a lot more follow-up research on what exactly it was that caused this wave.
And that's a first, right? I've never seen the light associated with the gravitational wave before,
which is to be expected because previously we've seen the collisions that were seen were black hole mergers.
But this one wasn't.
This was two neutron stars. And when two neutron stars collide, they create something that's called a kilonova, which is, as the name might suggest, is quite bright.
I'm guessing big nova.
Yes, very big nova. Many, many times brighter than your regular supernova. And it lasted a couple of days, and it was observed by pretty much every telescope that in the world that could get onto it, and some that weren't in the world, some of the space telescopes as well. It was the big thing that everybody had been waiting for. So they managed to do... They're still sort of, like, processing all of the data that happened. And one of the things that's really great about this is it happened when LIGO was linked to a third observatory called Virgo, which is over in Italy. And it was quite strange, though, because even though LIGO detected it, it's Virgo didn't, and that was what helped them pinpoint where it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So because LIGO, you have two observatories picking it up over in America, and they managed to give you a sort of fairly big area of sky where this thing might have been coming from. But because they had the non-detection over at Virgo, that said, well, there's only a certain plane where we wouldn't have detected this thing, so it must be in there. And that was how they tracked it down, because it wasn't seen rather than it was seen.
So process of elimination.
Yes.
So do you mean because of the position of the observatories, you could say, well, this one, the observatory in Italy didn't see it because the Earth was pointing away?
It's because usually you need at least 3 points of reference, that's what it's called, to be able to pinpoint pretty much anything, whether it's on the sky or in space. You know, to do triangulation, you need to have 3 points of reference. And so that's why it was really important to get Virgo online and working with LIGO. But I just thought it was quite strange that we found it because one of them didn't find it, which was quite odd.
Mm. One of the interesting things I think about the whole gravitational wave, and because the first discovery was announced in, was it February 2016?
2015.
Yeah, okay.
It was discovered in September 2015. It was announced in 2016, yes.
Yeah. And it's almost like the first exoplanet discovery, which I think was like 1992, and then there's just like a boom, and then it always just picks up. So like this year, I actually kind of found myself, whenever there was a gravitational wave announcement, because I think there were maybe like 2 or 3 this year, and 2 of them were black hole collisions, you kind of just, I caught myself thinking, it's just another black hole collision.
it's because it took 30 years for the technology to get to the point where the detectors could pick these up. And these occurrences don't appear to be exactly rare. It's just that we've only just got to the point where they are, where the technology can switch on to be able to detect them.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's,
I remember what you mean though, and there was definitely a swing in the last couple of years where every exoplanet announcement was really exciting. Mm. And now it's like, okay, one more on the tally, almost.
It's like you only really hear about them if it's the biggest or the brightest, or it's raining sunscreen.
Or it takes, or, you know, it takes something special like TRAPPIST-1 week and go, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's because it's something special. One thing I wanted to pick up on with gravitational waves is you've got a new buzzword from that discovery now, multi-messenger astrophysics.
Multi-messenger astrophysics, yes. Basically, what that means is any kind of astronomy when you are looking at more than one observation sort of thing. So you're looking at light in all of its various guises, so everything from radio, visible, gamma, X-rays, all of those.
Sure.
You've also got neutrino observatories are cropping up all over the world, which are usually giant tanks of water that can pick up these flashes of neutrinos when something big happens. You've got gravitational waves. Mm-hmm. You've got cosmic ray observatories, which are looking for the actual like heavy particles from cosmic rays. And it's when you put all of these different ways of doing things together that you can get a full picture of what's going on inside of these really extreme and exotic physics events that are happening out in space.
Ideally, we'd use multi-messenger astrophysics all the time, wouldn't we? But
it's one of those things that you want to be able to use it all the time, but it's only the sort of major events, unfortunately, that at the moment that we can get enough of this to be able to pick up, because it's really hard to pick up gravitational waves and neutrinos. Maybe in the future, though, we can be doing it for, you know, a solar flare on the sun and being able to pick up the gravitational impact of that, but not for a long, long time.
As I believe you spoke to someone about gravitational waves?
I did. I got to talk to David Reitze, who is the executive director over at LIGO, and knew all about the events that were going on there this year. So, David, tell us, for those of us, those listening at home who don't know what a gravitational wave is, what is a gravitational wave?
A gravitational wave is a ripple in space-time. That's the easiest way to think about it. Technically, it's a little more complicated than that. It's a fluctuation. It's literally a stretching and squeezing of space. And these are very difficult to detect, and they come about from any object that's accelerating. So if I have two black holes, for example, that are orbiting around one another, they're emitting gravitational waves. The analogy that people use, which is not so bad, is if I take a stone and drop it in a pond. All right, you can think of the surface of the pond as space, as a coordinate system. And when there's no stone there, you know, if it's really calm, the surface is very, very calm and very flat. But when a stone comes in, the stone perturbs the pond, the surface of the pond, which is what the masses do to space-time, and that produces ripples that flow outward. So these are literally dynamic fluctuations in space and time. And if you were to put rulers down, all right, near where you have gravitational waves being produced, the rulers would actually stretch. The coordinate system would actually stretch and compress. So it's a pretty unique phenomenon.
Mm. And gravitational waves have been in the news a lot in 2017. What big news has happened and come out in the last year?
There have been a number of major discoveries with gravitational waves, with LIGO and also the Virgo Observatory, which is in Pisa, Italy, outside of Pisa, Italy. First, we've discovered some more black holes. The first detection that we had in 2016 was the detection of two really massive black holes that were orbiting around one another and collided with one another. We've seen a few more of those in 2017, but I think the big scientific news was the observation of two neutron stars, a binary neutron star system that basically collided and merged and produced not only gravitational waves, which is what we saw, but also a great light show. I mean, the way I describe it is it's the most spectacular fireworks show in the universe. And this was an event that was captured by approximately 70 telescopes, and I include both ground-based telescopes and also satellites, space-based telescopes too. So it was a really, really fundamental and remarkable event, and we're still trying to understand some of the data. We still don't have a complete picture of what happened, but it was a really great event. And if I can add one more thing to that, the other big thing that happened is three of our founders who work in the LIGO laboratory won the Nobel Prize, so that's pretty exciting too.
And you say it was a brilliant fireworks show that accompanied this neutron star collision. Why was it so important that you could see it as well as hear the gravitational waves? I suppose
the idea behind what's known as multi-messenger astronomy is to be able to use the different kinds of information that cataclysmic astrophysical events such as neutron star collisions give you, to be able to give you a complete picture of what happened. So the gravitational waves are very good at looking at what happens before the merger occurs, as the objects are sort of spinning around one another and they're getting closer together. And then they collide and produce this sort of final blast of gravitational waves. And then the light show takes over. So very soon after that, in our case, it was about 1.7 seconds, a gamma ray burst was observed by the Fermi telescope and also by the Integral network. And then after that, because of the nature of these collisions, what happens is, you know, these objects are moving at very, very fast speeds when they collide, approximately a third of the speed of light. And they produce a huge amount of nuclear material, and that leads to a lot of interesting physical processes, but it also leads to the production of X-rays, of light, of visible light, of infrared light, and even eventually radio. So by studying these different colors, if you will, or different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, you can get a better understanding of what happens after a neutron star collides. And one of the things that has come out of this is this is an event that astronomers call a kilonova. All right. And it is thought to be, and we now know based on the observations, that this is where most of the heavy elements in the universe comes from. So the gold that you wear on your wedding ring, or the platinum or uranium. That all came from a collision much like this. And, you know, until we had seen that before, that was not possible. And you needed both the gravitational waves and the electromagnetic astronomy to be able to tell that story.
This August, it was the first time that LIGO ran alongside. The two observatories at LIGO ran alongside a third observatory of Virgo in Italy. Why has it taken so long to bring all three of them together?
So that's correct. The LIGO observatories started our run, actually, our first run in September of 2015. We were in our second run, which started November of 2016. Virgo, which is the observatory in Italy, started a little bit late. And the reason for that is simply their schedule for construction. So both interferometers had just come, or both LIGO and Virgo had just come through a major upgrade, where we made major changes. In the case of LIGO, we completely rebuilt the interferometer. And we had a schedule for doing that, and that schedule had us operating in late 2015. Virgo's schedule, just by virtue of the way their money, you know, funding, a lot of this is driven by, you know, if you have the funding to actually do the work. The way their schedule worked is they didn't come online until 2017. So, and the thing I'll point out is, and it's true for both LIGO and Virgo, is that these are incredibly complex and incredibly delicate instruments, and when you design them and put them together, you don't always get what you want, and you have to spend a lot of time trying to sort of understand the underlying problems and the underlying we call them noises that exist in the interferometer, and try to beat them down. So it's a really complicated business, and but it was fortunate that LIGO and Virgo were actually operating at the same time, because we wouldn't have seen this this kilonova event without having Virgo and the two LIGO detectors.
So is the end goal to have all three running alongside each other together and working as one?
That the end goal is to have is the two LIGO detectors, the Virgo detector. There is a detector now under construction in Japan called Kagra, and we're working on a detector in India. The Kagra detector hopefully will come online in 2019, perhaps a little earlier. The LIGO India detector in the middle of the next decade. So the idea is to have them all actually working together, because when you have them all working together, you can actually do a lot better than even just LIGO and Virgo can do to sort of identify the spot in the sky where the gravitational waves came from.
And also, it was only running for a month altogether, and you discovered, I think, at least two waves. Mm-hmm. Is this going to be, you know, a relatively common occurrence now that we're going to find these waves, or were we just lucky?
So I would say that Virgo was very lucky, is that they came on in the right time. All right, they were only on for a month, and in that month, two major discoveries were made. One was a black hole merger; the other was this kilonova binary neutron star merger event. So there was an element of luck to it. But I will say that we now know, because of all of the black holes collisions that we've seen, and even the one binary neutron star collision sort of tells us how often we expect to see these events. And right now, for example, LIGO is not running, Virgo is not running. We're in this process, we call it, of commissioning and upgrading. So we're trying to make our instruments even more sensitive. And the hope is that when we come back online, we'll be seeing a black hole collision every month, maybe even a little bit more frequently than that, and a binary neutron star collision probably maybe every half a year or something like that. So the idea is to really push the sensitivity so that we can make these kinds of detections more frequently, because the more times you see them, the more information you can sort of aggregate the information, and you learn a lot more about the underlying astrophysics of these processes.
So what can we expect to see from LIGO and the world of gravitational waves in general in 2018?
Not much. So I hate to say that, but during 2018, for most of the year, probably up until maybe September, perhaps even October, we will be in this mode where we're tuning up our instruments, where we're trying to make them better. So there will not be any, it is unlikely that there will be major discoveries during that time. It is possible, because we do run our instruments when we're in this commissioning mode or tuning mode, and if we do see something, of course, we'll report it. But We won't go back online until the end of next year, like I said, in the fall of 2018. And at that point, then the excitement might start to happen again. So again, we're quite confident that we're going to be seeing more and more of these black hole collisions. And that's interesting because they tell us about where these black holes come from. Be great to see a binary neutron star collision. The thing that we're really after now that we haven't seen, and they should exist, is a neutron star black hole merger. All right, that's something that they should be out there, and that will produce a different kind of gravitational wave. And so that's something that we're really interested in. It's quite possible that we'll be able to see gravitational waves from isolated neutron stars, just due to they spin around, and as they spin, if they have little mountains, that's a poor analogy, but it gives you an idea, that they'll produce gravitational waves. These are very, very weak emitters. It takes a long time to search for them. Could see something like that. And if we're really lucky, if a supernova goes off in our galaxy and just happens to pass, the gravitational waves from the supernova happen to pass through our detectors when we're running, we might be able to see that too. So a number of different sort of astrophysical targets that we're after.
Well, at least the next year I'll give the science guys some time to look at all of the data that they took
over the last year. We need a break.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us. It sounds like it's been an amazing year for gravitational waves, and it's only going to get better. So thank you very much, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, so for my pick of 2017, as kind of more of a collection of little picks, but something we've heard a lot more about this year is human spaceflight. More chatter, a bit more planning, a little more, dare I say it, posturing as well. But there seems to be a feeling that we're kind of moving towards something now. I mean, do you guys get that sense as well?
Yes. It's for years people have saying, let's go to Mars. But it does seem like people are actually getting their act together to do it.
Having some more concrete ideas. And again, we've had this kind of whole chat about, let's go back to the moon. And I think that's been going on basically since the India Apollo program. Mm. One thing that happened actually last night, which is the 11th of December, the time of recording, the anniversary of Apollo 17, no less, US President Donald Trump has signed a new space policy directive, which officially directs NASA to return to the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. Mm. To quote his directive, this time we will not only plant our flag and leave our footprints, we will establish a foundation for an eventual mission to Mars and perhaps someday to many worlds beyond. Now, at this point, it means very little in the sense that there are no kind of concrete details and there's a massive funding shortfall, which is addressed by a single line saying that work toward into the new directive will be reflected in NASA's fiscal year 2019 budget request.
Mm.
But it does mark a step change from the Obama administration. US President Barack Obama in 2010 said, I understand that some believe we should attempt to return to the surface moon first, as previously planned, but I just have to say pretty bluntly here, we've been here before. I mean, what do you guys think? Moon, Mars?
It's one of those things which it's a big thing of contention over in the US, especially amongst the political circles. There's an argument in both ways, which is, you know, if you can go to the moon, you can practice setting up a permanent station. You can practice long-haul flights before you send somebody on a two-year flight to go over to Mars, where they may or may not come back. So you can use it as a sort of stepping stone. There's a lot of people, though, that conversely say it's a waste of resources, you know. You can practice doing all of those things on the ISS or going to an asteroid or something. We should be forging new ground.
Well, funny you should mention about practice. Have you heard of the Deep Space Gateway, which is, again, something gaining traction this year? It is a proposed cislunar space station, which will be developed by NASA and Roscosmos, the Russian space agency. Cislunar meaning it'll sit between Earth and the moon. But that potentially could be a staging post for future missions, whether that's down to the moon itself and the idea of forming this permanent colony, or as a kind of a launch post into deep space. And potentially actually could be where they would even assemble the also in development deep space transport, which I'm sure you can guess where that's going to go.
Yeah, deep space.
Ding, ding, ding. Mars, especially.
Yes. Yeah. I do think that if we are going to go back to the Mars, we need to stay there for a bit rather than just, you know, have a bimble about. Did I say Mars? I meant the moon. If we're going to go back to the moon, we should stay there for a bit rather than just bimble about, pick up some rocks and come home.
Well, I'm going to say, if you're going to bimble about on Mars, that's quite an endeavour just for a bimble.
I know.
But yeah, there's also been lots of kind of discussions about the potential for, on the lunar far side, that there's, you know, it could be like ice water, and, you know, that that could be a potential resource. I mean, yeah, usually when, I mean, the kind of few prominent voices talking about going to Mars, you know, notably Buzz Aldrin this year has been kind of talking about it once again. And it does seem that, like, the moon, kind of a permanent base on the moon, is most of the time put forward as a kind of stepping stone to it. But, I mean, I guess we're kind of seeing a lot of the research that will go towards a potential journey to Mars. We're already kind of seeing with the experiments in the International Space Station, in terms of things like, you know, growing their own vegetables and, I mean,
Scott Kelly's year-long mission, that
Scott
kind
Kelly,
of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, very definitely. Lots of work going on about how astronauts will survive trip. We'll come on to that in a minute. But, you know, just this idea of Mars again and gone there. SpaceX founder Elon Musk has his very own definite ideas about Mars. And I think one of his estimates, it could be as soon as 2022.
Yeah,
he's always very ambitious with his deadlines.
He is, yep. But then I think, was it in 40 to 100 years he can get a permanent colony there? That doesn't sound right.
I don't know. It's quite difficult to kind of know which ambitious projects to kind of take seriously. Because
it's one of those things that if Apollo proved that if you throw enough money at it, you can make it happen. So I think that's going to be the question.
So where's the money come from?
Where's the money coming from?
I mean, there's only one thing that in April, again, the US President Donald Trump, he dialed up to the International Space Station and he asked them to go to Mars more quickly. I think it was kind of joking, but he was kind of saying, oh, we want that to be done in my first term, or if not my second.
Yeah.
So I don't know where that sits now. We've got this new space policy directive. But it's still quite an exciting time. And beyond that, you know, NASA is still developing its space launch system. Closer to home, China is still working on its Harmony of the Heavens space station, the one that could eventually, you know, fly alongside the ISS and perhaps, not replace, but, you know, it could become the focal point if and when the ISS finally reaches the end of its life. So, to find out more about the ongoing challenges astronauts themselves face when they're doing these projects and when they might go to Mars, I spoke to Libby Jackson, who is the author of A Galaxy of Her Own, Amazing Stories of Women in Space, and also Human Spaceflight and Microgravity Program Manager for the UK Space Agency. Libby, thank you for taking the time to speak to me.
Oh, no problem. Happy to be a part of the podcast. Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you can start. Could you tell us a bit about what happens to the human body in space, how spending time in a microgravity environment affects our bodies physiologically?
Of course. The human body is ever so adaptable. And as we've spent more and more time living and working in space on the International Space Station, we have learned so much about what happens. And whilst Tim Peake was up in space, and he got back a year and a half ago now, but he overlapped with Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko. And they both spent a year in space, so we've got even more data now. Really, your entire body just adapts to living in a weightless environment. So all the things that it doesn't need to do, it gets rid of. So you find your bones and your muscles deteriorate because you just don't need to use them when you're floating around. Your fluid through the body equilibrates. So here on Earth, we're used to gravity pulling us downwards all the time and all the blood sort of pulling downwards. And so it sort of equalizes through the body. You get puffy faces, puffy noses. The spinal fluid seems to perhaps increase in pressure. It's something we still don't fully understand, but certainly your intracranial pressure may change. And that may be linked to something we do know that happens, which is that your eyesight sometimes changes, perhaps because there's more fluid pressing in the eyeballs, so they change shape. All of this is really fine if all you want to do is stay in space. If you were going to spend the rest of your days floating in a microgravity environment, you'd be fine. Your body is adapting to that. But in any space mission, be it going around the Earth for 6 months or a year, or perhaps one day even going to the moon or to Mars, you ultimately want to land somewhere and then experience gravity again and function. And that's why astronauts on the space station do 2 hours of exercise every day, about an hour of cardio and an hour of what we call lifting weights. That they, of course, don't lift weights. They use hydraulic mechanisms for pressure. So they exercise their muscles. And that's all to try and minimize that loss of bone and muscle conditioning, so that when they land back on Earth, they're able to get out the spacecraft, to function, to survive that reentry, or to enjoy that reentry a little bit more. Usually, landings are planned and there's a crew waiting for you. But should there be an emergency and you need to come back to Earth in a hurry, you might be landing in the middle of the Kazakh steppe with nobody around to come and rescue you. And so it's very important that the astronauts can, in that situation, look after themselves. And they couldn't do it if they did no exercise.
And all these changes you're talking about, are they all temporary changes? Like, the body's so good at adapting to space, can it readapt back to Earth?
Generally, yes. It takes some time. It takes about a year for your bone density to get back to where it was after you've been in space. But some people do experience changes that seem to be more permanent, be that eyesight. There's been a few astronauts I hear of who have had changes in their intracranial pressure that haven't recovered after returning to Earth. So the body is very adaptable, but there are sometimes things that will have lasting impacts on you. And that's something that the space agencies are really looking at from a health perspective, but it also becomes an occupational health issue. If you're going to send an astronaut into space and they come back and they've then got things that are affecting them for the rest of their life, that's something their employers want to take care of. The other thing that you can't undo is the increased radiation exposure. So when you go to the International Space Station, you're still within the Van Allen belts. You're still protected by the Earth's magnetic sphere from all the cosmic and the solar radiation. But you still do get an increased dose. And that the space agencies, NASA, European Space Agency, and so on, they do have levels, and there are sort of lifetime doses that they'd like their astronauts to stay under. But if you were to go on to Mars, you'd be exceeding that hugely, because you would leave that protection of our magnetic field. And that's a challenge when we look at Mars that we're still looking at overcoming.
Well, that's a nice way to kind of bring into it, because, one idea we're hearing a lot more about in the past few months is this idea of sending humans to Mars. I mean, it's not a new idea, of course, but it's suddenly one we seem to be start talking about a bit more kind of definite plans about it. So, what challenges do we face actually getting there? Is radiation really the only one?
Radiation is one of them, but there are others. A trip to Mars with current propulsion technology, because of the way the planets work and the planets line up, you tend to be looking at a 6 to 9 month journey there. And then you'd have to stay on the surface for about a year before you had another 6 to 9 month journey back, because you just can't leave Mars when Earth is in the wrong place. We just haven't got the propulsion. So you need to sort out the radiation. If we can do anything to sort out the propulsion, to make us get there faster, to be more efficient, because we have to take everything there, that will help enormously. We would be spending, as I say, perhaps a year on the surface, and you need a lot of things to support a crew for a year on the surface, and all of that has to get there. So propulsion's a problem. When you get there, you have to land. And Martian atmosphere is much thinner than Earth atmosphere, and we've not been very good at landing probes and rovers there so far. It's about a 50-50 success rate that we've got. And one of the things is understanding how the Martian atmosphere works, how parachutes work, what other landing technologies we might have. So that's still something that people are looking at. On top of all of that, if you're going to send humans to Mars, you're at the mercy of the laws of physics. We communicate at the speed of light. Radio waves are how we send messages backwards and forwards. When Earth and Mars are at their closest, the one-way light travel time is about 4 minutes. at their most distant, that's over 20 minutes. And so the ability for us to send instant messages backwards and forwards between a crew on the surface and Earth is going to be impossible. So your mission control setup that we are so used to here, that we have looking after the crews on the space station 24 hours a day, they won't be able to help instantly the crew. They won't be able to help the crew instantly in the way that they can now. And the crew who are on the surface of Mars will be cut off in some ways from everybody back on Earth. They'll be very isolated. And how will we deal with those challenges? They'll certainly still be able to communicate, but they won't be able to have a telephone call or a radio conversation like they would now. Then you've got things like food to consider, planetary protection aspects. We're sending humans there to go and study life. And did Mars support life? Does it support it now? But if we send humans, we're sending life there. And what does that mean? So there are an awful lot of challenges to overcome. But we are in a time, as you say, where we're starting to do things. I think Mars might just be getting closer down the horizon.
Yeah, it certainly feels like it. But they would have to be entirely self-sufficient as well. It's not just the like not being able to communicate instantly. It's like if you're, I don't know, a water purifier, let's say, breaks, then you've got to have the ability to fix that, surely.
Yeah, exactly. We're looking at, can you have closed life support systems? We will need something like that. We'll need to be able to grow food. You can't take a year's supply of tinned food. 3D printing, additive manufacturing, that's likely to come into play so that you can take a supply of material and then print the tools you need or the parts you need when you need them, rather than taking every single spare part, which would be much better for the mass that you need to take there. So that's definitely an issue, and it's something that's being looked at now.
And in the context of everything you just said, what do you think is going to be the biggest next big challenge, I guess, for human space? Because Mars is kind of the end goal, I guess. What's the next thing we have to overcome to kind of make that a bit more of a reality?
Well, it's a really exciting time in the world of human spaceflight. I don't think we've had as an exciting time for quite some years. The International Space Station is going to be in orbit until 2024. It might get extended. But the space agencies of the world, NASA, European Space Agency, Roscosmos and JAXA and so on, are starting to look to low Earth orbit becoming a commercial environment. So they're starting to say to companies, you need to look after this. And that allows them to free up the resources to then cast our sights and our goals back out outside of low Earth orbit. The Deep Space Gateway, as it's being called, is being discussed now. NASA have said they're working towards it. The European Space Agency are looking at it. And hopefully in a few years' time at the ministerial coming up, we might see commitments and agreements being made there. And it's something that everybody's looking at, saying, yes, we want to build this. The Orion spacecraft, which is a NASA capsule with a European Space Agency service module, is being built. And that has to go somewhere, and it will likely go to the Deep Space Gateway. And this little mini space station with just a few modules, nothing like the size of the space station, the International Space Station, would allow crew to go and visit for 30 days, a month, 2 months, 3 months, explore, learn what it's like to live outside of those radiation belts, allow us to do science that we can't do here in low Earth orbit, but that we can do out there. And then this space station, this Deep Space Gateway, would act as a stepping stone. It would be a launching off point for sorties down to the lunar surface, and then also onto Mars. So this stepping stone, the Deep Space Gateway, does start to enable these things. And as I say, that the Orion spacecraft is being built, it's going through testing. The Deep Space Gateway is being very seriously discussed at the minute. And if all of that happens and everybody agrees to do it, suddenly we will be looking at humans leaving low Earth orbit for the first time since 1972. And that just, changes everything. It's a hugely exciting time. It's exploration going out there. But it's all being done because it has good scientific and economic benefits. And we're exploring because we know that we will find out things that help everybody back on Earth.
That's a hugely exciting time, isn't it?
Oh, I can't wait.
Just one final question then. Do you feel that we need to go back to the moon before we can go on to Mars, so we have that kind of stepping stone?
It's a great area of discussion at the moment. The European Space Agency's Director General is saying, is proposing an idea of a moon village, something perhaps a bit more permanent. It's a concept in his mind. The UK is looking at these things, and we do see that a stepping stone to the moon is going to be important because it will allow us to test out technologies, learn how to do things like in-situ resource utilization, like landing technologies, just going somewhere and trying out some of the concepts there in a relatively safer environment. It's only a few days back to Earth, and it could only be a few hours potentially back to the Deep Space Gateway. On to Mars is a huge step, and I think that the moon does offer the ability to trial some of those technologies. But if we go and start colonizing it, if we really said, no, we want a permanent base there, what we would see is that in the end, resources are finite, money is finite. That would sort of drain, I think, a lot of resources, and we would find it very difficult to do that and go on to Mars. And Mars is where the exciting science is. The question of is or was there life on Mars? That is one of the real drivers for sending humans there, because they will be able to look at the surface, the rocks, in a way that rovers are superb, but are gives us a different perspective, and by going onto Mars, that's something that then humans can do.
That's brilliant, Libby. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Now we have a 2017 retrospective edition of News Bingo. I've got 7 questions based on some of the biggest news stories and events of 2017. You guys both have bits of paper in front of you, so you can write your answers down, not spoil it for each other. Mm-hmm. And hopefully you guys at home will play along too. So, shall we get on with it?
Here we go.
Yes.
Okay. We're starting right at the beginning of the year. In January, the Japanese space agency JAXA began testing its Kite mission, one of many in development to tackle the burgeoning problem of defunct satellites in orbit, space junk.
Mm-hmm.
What's it going to use to gather this space junk up?
I think I know this one.
Let's hear
right.
it.
Right. You got it, Ian?
Yeah, I don't know, so my answer is a ridiculous answer.
I think it's a giant fishing net, essentially.
Oh, it's almost there.
Okay, well, I mean, mine was supposed to be a bit of a comedy answer. I've written a massive net and a magnet.
You see, you're both kind of there. It's an amateur man net.
It's just a wire or something, and it's going to go through and pick up all of the like flecks of paint and debris and like the tiny bits.
It's an electromagnetic fishing line.
That was it.
Essentially. Oh. It's going to, basically, like, imagine a whip. I'm going to throw it at Ian, and it's going to latch onto him, and then I'm going to tug him out of orbit.
Thanks, Kev.
Yeah, and then he's going to burn up. Bye, Ian.
Well, I wasn't too far off with a massive net and a magnet.
No, I've given you both half a point for
that.
Yay!
Moving on to something that, well, our readers will know. In April, the Scarlet Knight TV show celebrated its 60th birthday, and believe it or not, the TV show is older than the space age itself. But what did Patrick talk about on that very first episode?
Oh no. I should know this, because I wrote about it.
It's always a way of something to write about.
Okay.
It was a celestial object.
I can half remember.
Ian?
Bit of a guess. This might be coming from the recesses of memory, or it might just be a guess. I suspect it was something like a tour around the Orion constellation, something like that.
It was not, as
it was. I think it was a comet of some description.
It was,
and its name. It had a double barrel name, and I think it was AR.
It is. Yeah. Can you get any closer? No. It's Comet Arendt-Roland.
Yes, that one.
That's the one, yes. I think our readers would have trumped you.
No.
I would say so, yeah.
Right. Cassini mission.
Yeah.
We talked about it earlier. Came to its end in September, not with a whimper but a bang, when it was crashed deliberately into Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
No, this one.
Come on, then. Or Ian first.
Because you have bodies like Enceladus that could potentially harbour life because they have salty liquid water, you can't risk contaminating the Saturnian system with a human-made object.
As I can see, you've got precisely the same, Dan, and you're both exactly right.
Yeah, you don't want to go back to Enceladus and then find a bunch of human bacteria left by Cassini.
Funny enough, this is one of the questions raised by Elon Musk saying he's going to send his Tesla Roadster to Mars orbit, because I don't think Elon Musk technically, or SpaceX technically, has to follow the outer planet kind of protection guidelines.
Apparently it's okay, because he's not actually going to put it into orbit around Mars, he is going to put it into the orbit of Mars. As in, around the Sun.
Okay.
And that's okay, because the chance of it actually hitting something where it might contaminate.
That's not how I read that, but I know it was a tweet, so it's quite...
Yeah, it's one of those things that he clarified later.
Right, okay, that makes much more sense.
I read that this morning.
I mean, could he potentially get a car custom-made in one of those, you know, dirt-free, sanitised environments?
Well, he owns the company, so probably.
Yeah.
But it would just be a case of whether he can get that done by later this month.
Something else I discovered quite recently, is when they were building Curiosity, and I think they'd, Curiosity rover, the one that went to Mars, had to undergo some of the most stringent cleansing processes because it was going to Mars, and that's like, you know, we can't contaminate Mars at all.
Yeah.
And when after they'd like done the first set and they checked it, it still had like 317, I think it was, types of bacteria on it. And some of those are the most resistant, the ones that survive UV. And
yeah. Life doesn't like to die.
Life is hardy.
Yeah.
But the idea that, like, you know, how long would it take to make a Tesla Roadster in those conditions?
Quite a while.
Back to anniversaries. August marked another 50th. It was the 50th anniversary of the first pulsar being discovered. Pulsars being super dense, ultra compact stars that spin rapidly and shoot out beams of radio waves like cosmic lighthouses.
Mm-hmm.
Who discovered the first one? Go.
Mm-hmm. Dame Jocelyn Bell.
Boom.
Yeah.
Yep, both right. She was a student at the time, I believe, and then she discovered it with her
supervisor at the time.
She's from Northern Ireland as well, so big shout out.
More anniversaries to come. August and September marked the 40th anniversaries of the Twin Voyager spacecraft, two probes that pretty much rewrote textbooks on the outer planets. The last big milestone for this mission was in 2012. What was it?
Okay.
Was
it really that far long ago? Oh, my goodness.
Did you say, the last big milestone?
Yeah. I mean, they're both still sending that data. They're both still working. But the, like, kind of really big announcement of it was 2012.
Okay.
You go first, Des.
It crossed over the boundary into interstellar space.
Absolutely right.
Well, yeah, I've
Voyager 1.
I've written it left the solar system.
Oh, Ian, that's a point of contention.
Yeah.
Mm. So you're absolutely right. It was Voyager 1, did enter interstellar space. Funnily enough, even though I said it happened in 2012, NASA didn't actually find out until 2013, because the instrument that would have detected that had broken many years before. And it was only when a coronal mass ejection from the 2012 caught up with it
13
months later, they were able to tell. The reason why the solar system is a bit of point of contention here is because it depends where you define the end of the solar system.
Mm.
So some people talk about that as like, oh, you know, the realm of the planets. You could also say it's the sun's influence, which would count as going into interstellar space. But if you're talking about the Oort cloud, and you say the Oort cloud is the bound of the solar system, I think it's 40,000 years till it gets there.
So give it to me straight, Kev.
You're not getting a point.
Oh, come on. Half a point?
You can have half a point. Yes. I'll give you that.
Thanks, Kev.
Question six. In January, again, a famous figure from the world of space passed away. He was best known for something he described as a very dubious and disappointing honour. Who was he, and what was he talking about?
Oh, no.
No, that's right.
Yeah, but I can't remember his name.
Oh, no. Ian, do you know?
I think it was the passing of former astronaut Gene Cernan.
It was.
He was the last man on the moon.
Yes.
Yes.
But I think he liked to be referred to as the most recent man on the moon.
Yes. It was definitely the last man on the moon because, I mean, obviously he loved the moon, but it was that, the fact that no one had been back that really irked him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he passed away on the 16th of January and he was on the moon with Apollo 17, December 1972.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, in mid-October, astronomers in Hawaii discovered what has been repeatedly described as one of the most elongated cosmic objects known to science. What are they talking about, and why is it special?
Do I have to spell it right?
If you can spell it, I will give you a bonus point.
Ooh, class.
There might be a few too many letters in there.
I feel like your bigger problem is, can you pronounce it?
No. Okay.
Ian knows, I think, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's pronounced Oumuamua, and it was an asteroid that has reached our solar system from interstellar space.
Mm-hmm.
The first ever such object to be observed.
Yeah. Both quite right, yes. The first interstellar asteroid, I mean, long theorised, but much like gravitational waves, never seen, and then suddenly. So I don't know. Maybe we'll find more, but I don't think it works the same way with interstellar asteroids.
It's one of those things where they reckon about one comes through every year.
Oh, really?
But it comes through the solar system. But in order for us to see it, it needs to come relatively close. Because I can't remember exactly how dark this thing was, but it wasn't exactly obvious. It was just because it came right by Earth.
No.
Well, in astronomical terms, anyway.
Do you know that SETI are going to examine it this week?
Cool.
Oh, can they still see it?
Still see it. Greenbank telescope should be able to just pick up faint signals on it, but they are looking for signs of alien technology.
Really?
Yeah. Of course cool. They are.
There's something SETI about the shape of it that's apparently intrigued them.
Hmm.
Yes. Well, it's supposed to be 10 times longer than it is wide or thick.
Yeah,
so
it's very long and thin, kind of sci-fi spaceshipy kind of shape. You can imagine it, can't you?
Yeah.
Like the big monolith from 2001.
Yeah.
Can I try and spell it and get the bonus point?
You can.
Okay. There is a little apostrophe before the name starts, and then it's Oumuamua.
Hooray!
Did I get it?
Bonus point.
Yes!
I don't know if there is an apostrophe, actually.
There is an apostrophe.
You're right.
Yes.
To get an extra bonus point for the apostrophe?
No.
No.
You can't have two bonus points.
Just because I put an extra N in there.
Wow. That bonus point has made all the difference. Ez has come out with a respectable 5.5, whereas Ian's just pipped her with 6.
Yay!
Oh, that's not fair.
Nice one.
So Ian's buying the champagne later.
The perfect end
that's
to
fair.
A perfect year.
And well done at home if you did better than these two. Right, Ez, you're going to tell me about 2018.
So it's been a fantastic year in 2017, and 2018 looks like it's going to be even more spectacular. Unfortunately, there's been a couple of missions that have been delayed from 2018, most notably the James Webb Space Telescope, but there's still going to be a lot happening that we could look forward to. NASA will be sending their InSight mission to Mars. ESA and the JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, will be sending BepiColombo to Mercury in October, though that will take a good 6 years to finally get there, as will the Parker Solar Observatory, which is heading towards the Sun later this year as well. Two missions that have already been on their way for several years, OSIRIS-REx and Hayabusa 2, which are on their way to Ryugu and Bennu, which are two asteroids, and they should get there in about summer this year. There's going to be a whole host of people heading towards the moon, Most notably, the Chinese Space Agency, who might be putting the first probe on the dark side of the moon, or rather the far side of the moon, I should say.
Can I just interject? Are there actually people heading to the moon?
There might be people heading around the moon, according to SpaceX, but they've been a bit quiet on that front for a while. But there will be lots of probes heading that way with the Google Lunar X Prize.
Oh, yes, of course.
We also have two exoplanet missions to look forward to in the form of CHESS and CHEOPS, as well as a whole run of crewed missions. Most excitingly, the first ever test flights of the private commercial crew modules from SpaceX and Boeing, which might be making it to the ISS this year.
Fingers crossed.
So, fingers crossed. And if you want to hear more about that, then you can pick up the January issue.
Yes, if you've liked what you've heard on the podcast and want to learn more about space and astronomy, do pick up our January issue, as well as a look ahead at 2018. We're going to be examining 10 of the most mind-boggling space discoveries ever made. We're going to tell you how to find the planets in the night sky without a map and discover how artificial intelligence could change the nature of astronomical research.
And in this issue's bonus content, Scott Kelly has been visiting the UK over the past few weeks as we're recording, and we got to meet up with him and chat to him, and we managed to record it. So if you want to see that interview, pick up a copy of the issue, and it's available on the bonus content.
Scott Kelly is the ISS astronaut.
Of course.
The one-year mission, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. March 16th, he touched down back on Earth after spending a year on the ISS. So I spoke to him about what it was like to spend a year in space. And also, Ezzy's been talking to someone quite interesting this month, which is also included in the bonus content. Andy Weir, author of The Martian, and Ezzy's been talking to him about his new book, Artemis.
Awesome. Plus, you know, the magazine has our monthly Sky Guide and equipment reviews.
BBC Sky Night Magazine is available in print and several digital formats. Find out more at skynightmagazine.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store. Also, from it says, this has been Radio Astronomy. We have been BBC Sky at Night Magazine. And all that's left is for us to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.